On January 15th of 1947, in the Limerick Park area of Los Angeles, California, a young mother was out walking an early morning errand with her three-year-old daughter. She saw what she thought were two pieces of a store mannequin lying in a grassy vacant lot. She was shocked to realize it was actually a nude woman's body, cut in two at the waist. Both body parts were face up, and the woman's arms were stretched out over her head at about a 45-degree angle. The lower half of the body was situated about a foot away from the rest of the torso, and the victim's legs were spread open. In a hideous and ironic display of mutilation, the woman's mouth had been slashed in both corners, forming what resembled a grotesque smile. She had dark black hair, and her skin was almost porcelain white, even more so from near complete lack of blood. The woman came to be known as the Black Dahlia. Some say her hair color was the reason for the name. Others said it was a play on the title The Blue Dahlia, a 1946 movie in which a man killed his wife. Regardless, the media has a penchant for giving nicknames to killers, and in some cases, their victims. Now, we all know that cases of brutality against women, as well as men, cut across time and place, as do horrible post-mortem mutilations. Although they're rare, murder mutilation cases are considered by many behavioral analysts to be among those crimes that most lend themselves to psychological profiling. And they typically have sexual underpinnings. A special forensic category known as lust murder involves fantasizing about and then deriving erotic pleasure from killing in an intimate way, sometimes during sex, and not uncommonly followed by genital mutilation or evisceration of the victim. Another common feature of these types of horrible crimes is posing the body after death, often to shock those who discover the corpse, as well as consuming the blood or tissue of the victim or keeping body parts for trophies. Frequently, the killer's actions escalate over time in a string of murders and mutilations. Torturing the victims prior to death is typically part of the serial killer's sick fantasy. Some also engage in necrophilia after the murder. Many psychologists believe this type of so-called paraphilia, or sexual deviance, relates to childhood trauma, and the killings represent a way to try to get back at the person who harmed the perpetrator as a child. And when the murders don't satisfy the killer's needs or make him whole again, they often lead to a vicious cycle of increasing violence. Now, I say he because the vast majority of these kinds of perpetrators are men, many of whom kill only women, such as Jerry Brudos, the shoe fetish slayer of Oregon, who killed and mutilated four women in the late 1960s. Ted Bundy, who murdered over 30 women in a reign of terror across the United States in the 1970s. And Gary Ridgway, the Green River Killer, who's estimated to have killed over 90 women and girls in Washington State in the 1980s and 90s, often returning to their dead bodies for further sexual gratification. Other lust murderers killed couples, but usually only sexually abused or mutilated the women of the pair, such as Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker, who killed at least 13 people in California in the 1980s. In the USSR, the Butcher of Rostov, Andrei Chikatilo, sadistically took the lives of over 50 people in the 1980s. His victims included women, but also children of both sexes. Others seemed less discriminate, like Peter Curtin, known as the Vampire of Dusseldorf, who killed an unknown number of men, women, and children in the 1929 and 1930 period, perhaps as many as 60 people. Some serial lust killers preferred males. That was the case with John Wayne Gacy, the Killer Clown, who murdered at least 33 boys in the 1970s in Chicago. Jeffrey Dahmer killed 17 males in the Midwestern U.S. from the late 1970s to early 90s, and he cannibalized some of them. Moscow's Sergei Golovkin, called the Fisher, butchered 11 boys in the 1980s and 90s. Infrequently, couples commit lust murders together, like Fred and Rosemary West, who often in their own home tortured, raped, and murdered around a dozen young women and girls in England, mostly during the 1970s. Ian Brady and Myra Hindley committed what are called the Moore's murders of five children in England during the mid-1960s. Although there have been serial killers who were women, they typically don't fit the lust murder profile and are more likely to kill lovers or their own children, not strangers. Other women become these delusional angels of mercy who kill feeble or disabled people. A notable exception is Eileen Wuornos, a lesbian who killed 7 men in Florida between 1989 and 1990. Wuornos was alleged to have suffered childhood trauma like most lust murderers, but she shot her victims, which is not an intimate killing, and she didn't mutilate or cannibalize them. Interestingly, a book released in 2012 claims that the reason London's Jack the Ripper has never been identified is because the killer was a woman. But I don't buy it. Despite many suspects and much reexamination, no one will likely ever know the identity of that most notorious lust murderer. That's one of the commonalities between the Ripper cases of 1888 and the 1947 Black Dahlia killing that opened this lecture. Although authorities know who all the victims were, they have never been able to figure out who brutally killed and mutilated any of those women. So, now let's return to the scene where the Black Dahlia's body was discovered and look for other ways in which this case is and is not like those of legendary Jack the Ripper. Now, first off, in both the Black Dahlia and most of the Ripper murders, onlookers, the press, even the police themselves quickly and severely compromised scene evidence in its recovery. This is, or used to be, all too common at locations where crimes occur or bodies are disposed of in populated areas, especially outdoors. Since those days, we have come a long way in recognizing how easy it is to contaminate a scene. That's because we now understand so much more about and can do a lot more with what's called trace evidence. When found at a crime scene, tiny bits of material directly translate to pieces of information. But only with the recognition that it's there, even if difficult or impossible to see with the naked eye. Valuable trace evidence can be trampled on, even by investigators. It can stick to people's shoes or clothing and be unwittingly removed from the scene, or larger pieces of evidence even taken as ghoulish souvenirs by curious onlookers. Stranger things have happened. Another problem with over-aggressive interest in a scene is the introduction of lots of other non-essential data, like hairs and clothing fibers that fall off of observers. When those samples are discovered, it complicates the analysis and it wastes time, since it focuses attention on evidence that really has nothing to do with the victim or the perpetrator. But really, when you consider the discovery of a body in that vacant lot, where people routinely dump trash, the odds of finding trace evidence related to the crime, other than maybe on the body itself, would be pretty remote. Still, the entire area and all things in it had to be carefully examined. As soon as they reached the scene, detectives immediately knew they were dealing with a highly unusual and high-profile case. Now, the lead detective was a senior LAPD officer who had literally written the book on protecting crime scenes and preserving evidence. But significant damage had already been done, since people, especially the journalists, were already walking around the area snapping photos of the body. They were throwing cigarette butts and used flash bulbs all around. Even though police tried to move onlookers away, some parked nearby and literally stood on the roofs of their cars to see what was going on. So let's look at what police discovered when examining the scene. Well, for one thing, there was no blood on the ground around the remains. Now, what does that tell us? It tells us Dahlia's body had to be brought to the site rather than killed where it was discovered as Jack the Ripper's victims had been. Also, unlike the Ripper victims, the Black Dahlia had rope marks on her wrists, ankles, and her neck, causing police to suspect she had been tortured before she was killed. And the body appeared to be literally empty of blood. The detectives even wondered if ropes had been used to hang the victim like a meat carcass to drain her of her blood. Now, as was suspected in the Ripper killings, police thought the perpetrator might have some type of anatomical knowledge, was maybe a butcher or perhaps even a physician or maybe a student at the local university medical school. By comparing the amount of dew in the grass around the victim versus what was beneath her, scene investigators surmised the body parts were deposited around 2 o'clock in the morning on the day the body was discovered. Detectives figured the perpetrator had parked in a nearby driveway that led into the lot. they believe the two body parts were carried in one at a time, perhaps suggesting a single perpetrator. There were bits of debris on the upper half of the body that indicated to them it was originally face down, but had been turned face up for display. The lower half of the body had been dragged in on an empty cement bag, which was found nearby with traces of watered down blood on it. They also saw a heel print, but it had already been run over by tire tracks. Before the body parts were taken from the scene, detectives did collect some trace evidence off the body. What they found were tiny bits of a bristle-like material, which they thought could be from maybe broom straw or possibly from the floor mat of a car. Now, what about Dahlia's autopsy reports? Not only had the body been drained of blood, it appeared to have been washed clean. Like more than half the Ripper victims, the Dahlia had been eviscerated. Her intestines were found tucked underneath her body before they transported her to the morgue. She had bruising of the face and the right side of her head that showed she had been bludgeoned while still alive, since bruising doesn't happen after death. Investigators suspected she may have been tortured for even days before dying. Now, the cause of death was ruled to be blunt force trauma to the head and resulting subsequent loss of blood. It was obvious the manner of death was homicide. Although the body was examined for trace evidence, like foreign hairs or other fibers, they didn't find anything other than those tiny bristles I mentioned. And that's perhaps because the body had been washed. Even the victim's hair appeared to have been cleaned. And just like in the Ripper murders, there were no traces of semen found in or on the body and no evidence for vaginal intercourse. In the Dahlia case, the victim had instead been sodomized, and the medical examiner believed the penetration to have been post-mortem. In other words, it was done after she was dead. And there's a myth that often circulates that the Dahlia was unable to have vaginal intercourse due to undeveloped sex organs, but the autopsy report documents her genitalia as normal. Now, by measuring the lengths of both body segments, the woman's height was recorded as 5 feet 5 inches tall, and together the two body parts weighed about 115 pounds. They estimated her age to be between 15 and 30 years, but I can tell you as an anthropologist that some decent x-rays or an examination of her skeleton could have narrowed that range down quite a bit. But when you're trying to find the identity of an unknown person, it's always better to be broad than narrow, just to make sure you capture the normal amount of human variation. The Dahlia had a slight build, a small nose, a round chin, and gray-green eyes. Her teeth were said to be in a poor state of dental care, but her toenails were brightly polished red. Because of the cut marks and bruises to her face, morgue photos were given to a police artist to generate a more presentable likeness that they could release to the media in the hopes of a quick identification. We still do that today, only now we often use computer technology. The artist's images were released in that afternoon's paper, and calls started pouring in about possible missing persons, but none of them checked out. So how did they ultimately discover the identity of the woman known as the Black Dahlia? Now, this is a pretty cool part of the story. The victim had been fingerprinted as soon as she was brought into the Los Angeles County Morgue at 2:45 in the afternoon, even before the autopsy. They did that so the prints could be sent that night by special delivery airmail to the FBI. But this was January, and snowstorms throughout the U.S. were delaying plane flights. They estimated that it could be as long as a week before the prints would be actually delivered to the FBI. And in this kind of a horrendous case, that was a delay the investigation just couldn't afford. Today we have what's known as the Integrated Automated Fingerprint Identification System, better known as IAFIS, which allows digitized prints to be compared within a matter of seconds to fingerprints anywhere in the world using computer technology. Now, they had nothing like that back in 1947. But the latest technology did play a role in the Black Dahlia's ultimate identification. Faced with the potential delay in airmailing the fingerprints, the editor of the LA Herald Examiner got the bright idea to send the prints using some cutting-edge newspaper technology. Now, I can tell you from my many years in forensics, at times the media can be your worst enemy in an investigation. But in other situations, it can be your best ally. And that was certainly the case here for the LAPD. Have you ever heard of a thing called a sound photo machine? It was an early means of sending images over telegraph wires. By the time the journalists and investigators considered this option, the news wires were already closed for the night. But the Los Angeles International News photo wire would open at 4 o'clock the next morning, which would be 7 o'clock in the morning in Washington, D.C. So at 4:02 a.m., the victim's prints were sent over the wires to an FBI agent waiting at the Hearst News Bureau at the other end. Now, this was the first time anything like this type of evidence transfer had been tried. But there was a problem. The printed results in D.C. were blurry, and they were really hard to read, let alone classify into the types of searchable fingerprint codes that were in common use in comparisons. And the comparisons were still done by hand at that time. So the photo guys at the L.A. Herald Examiner put their heads together. They decided maybe they could use the fingerprints like negatives, then enlarge the images, and perhaps get better results. So they created a single 8x10 image of each individual fingerprint and then wired each of the 10 prints separately. The resulting images were good enough to be confidently classified by the FBI agents on the other end. And within minutes, the Black Dahlia was known to be 22-year-old Elizabeth Short, originally born in Massachusetts, but who had worked for about 4 years before as a civilian employee at Camp Cook Army Base in California. And that's why her fingerprints were on file. Short was one of five daughters born to a Massachusetts couple. During the Depression, her father lost his business and ultimately parked his car on a bridge to fake a suicide and abandon his family. He headed off to California and a while later contacted his wife, but she refused to take him back. And when Elizabeth Short was 19 years old, she decided to join her father in California. Now, Short was very pretty and had hopes of making it big in the movies or maybe as a model. But when her dad threw her out due to her laziness and late nights, she went to work at the nearby Army base. That's where she earned the nickname Camp Cutie because she was such a flirt. In 1943, Short was arrested in Santa Barbara for underage drinking, and her mugshot from that arrest has become iconic in this case. Now, Short sometimes worked as a waitress and lived in either cheap boarding houses or apartments with other single girls. She was said to have lots of acquaintances, but really no close friends. Short moved around a lot and was always low on cash. People said whatever money she had, she'd spend on clothes rather than buy food, and she often dressed all in black. Now, Short went out almost every night and allegedly preferred the company of strangers. She ate when men took her to clubs or to restaurants, she accepted their gifts, and because she was very pretty, Short always had a lot of dates. There was never any evidence of prostitution, though. She simply appeared to take advantage of the kindness in others. In short, pardon the bad pun, she was known as a beautiful freeloader. So how does Short's victim profile compare with Jack the Ripper's targets? All of them were females living in poverty and relying on the generosity of others. All were known to drink and cavort with men, often strangers. And if I've learned one thing about victim profiles in my many years in forensics, it's that people who regularly engage in high-risk behaviors are much more likely to wind up in the morgue than those who don't. Another thing is that Los Angeles, especially the Hollywood area, was a beacon for women who wanted to use their female attributes to strike it big. Sort of the way the East End of Ripper's London was flooded with its own immigrants seeking a better life in the big city. The results are not often good, and the stories too frequently do not have happy endings. Now, what about suspects? Or who may have been seen or known anything about Elizabeth Short's death or body disposal? As in the Ripper killings, police immediately began to canvass the neighborhoods to look for potential witnesses or possible suspects. In the Black Dahlia case, they quickly went to interview Short's father, who who, despite living about three blocks away, hadn't talked to his daughter in almost 3 years. Investigators talked to people at the Army base and lots of men who were former boyfriends. But curiously, and unlike the Ripper murders, dozens of people came forward to confess to Elizabeth Short's death, including both men and women. Now, clearly, these were attention seekers, something Hollywood is known for, and none of these leads checked out. The last person claiming to see Short alive was a 25-year-old married salesman named Robert Manley, who went by the nickname Red. He had met Short about a month before her death. 1 week before her body was found, Manley picked Short up from a friend's home, and the two went out partying and then spent the night in a hotel together. Manley insisted they did not have sex, and the next day he drove Short to the very glamorous Biltmore Hotel in L.A., where she said she was meeting her sister. And Manley said when he last saw Short, she was on the phone in the hotel lobby, and he went home. Police did hold Manley as a suspect, but he not only passed a polygraph lie detector test, but he had a solid alibi for the night the Dahlia's body was dumped. 8 days after Short's body was found, a man who said he was the killer phoned the editor of the L.A. Herald Examiner. Similar to the way the London newspapers received notes in 1888, allegedly from Jack the Ripper. Now, this caller said he was disappointed that the news around the Black Dahlia case was dying down, and so he was going to send them some of Short's belongings. The next day, a package arrived with several items, including photos, Short's birth certificate, and an address book with the name Mark Hansen embossed on it. Now, we'll come back to that in a minute. Police tried to find fingerprints on a note that came with the package, but it had apparently been washed with gasoline, ruining any type of potential evidence. So the next day, they found a black purse and one black shoe that was observed on top of a trash can several miles from where Short's body had been discarded. Red Manley was ultimately the one who identified those items as hers, saying that the purse smelled of the perfume she wore, and the shoe was one that he himself had paid to have resold for her. After years of depression, Manley's wife had him committed in 1954, and at that point they gave him sodium pentothal, which is better known as truth serum, but he passed a polygraph, so most still think he was not the killer. So who was this Mark Hansen, the guy whose address book was sent to the newspaper? Well, he was a nightclub owner that had befriended Short. In fact, between May and October of 1946, Short had actually lived at his home, sharing a room with Hansen's girlfriend. Now, Hansen admitted that the book was his, but clearly Elizabeth had been using it. Police questioned him, and they also questioned all the others listed in the address book, but with no results. Now, during a follow-up inquest in 1951, Hansen was still among the main suspects, but no charges were ever filed, and he died in 1964. All types of true crime websites and many books about the case detail about, you know, many other possible suspects, but it appears we may never know who actually killed Elizabeth Short. Personally, what I find most interesting and unusual about the Black Dahlia case, as contrasted with all the other lust murders I briefly reviewed at the start of this lecture, is that her brutal death and violent mutilation appears to have been a single, isolated incident. Strangely, no other similar cases in the Los Angeles area have been definitively linked to Short's death. And given the typical pattern of multiple killings, often starting in many classic cases with animal cruelty during childhood or teenage years, why would, or even how could, a lust murderer limit himself to just a single killing? Why did the brutality start or stop with Short? Well, we can't know for certain that it did. The Hollywood area is notorious for having somewhat of a transient population, and I'm sure there were countless young women listed as missing persons around that time. So, is it possible the killer continued to prey on women but just got more careful about body disposal? Well, in my mind, that doesn't fit with the killer's MO of dumping the body in a public place and posing the victim. I mean, he wanted Short's body to be found, to show off his perversion and to shock the sensibilities of the community. So if he murdered others, it wouldn't make sense to go underground with his work all of a sudden. The Jack the Ripper killings also ended abruptly. And either the thinking is the murderer either died or was incarcerated for another crime or maybe moved somewhere else. But in the Dahlia case, maybe the reverse is possible. Maybe a serial killer operating somewhere else came to Los Angeles, perhaps for a vacation or another visit, just to commit this single horrible crime. This line of reasoning led investigators to start looking at other similar incidents throughout the United States at the time. Now, many suspected the Black Dahlia case could be linked to what are known as the Cleveland Torso Murders. That's a string of at least a dozen unsolved killings and mutilations in Ohio in the 1930s. But is the Dahlia murder of 1947 a good fit? I don't see it. For one thing, the Cleveland Torso murderer chose both male and female victims who were mostly just poor drifters. Some of them were cut across the waist, as with the Black Dahlia case, but in every single one of the Cleveland Torso murders, the victim was decapitated. Police also tried to link the Dahlia case to three murders in Chicago that happened in the 2 years prior to Dahlia's death, in 1945 and in 1946. Those murders were two women and then a six-year-old girl. Together, those three cases have been called the lipstick murders due to a message written in lipstick on the wall at the scene of the apartment of the second murder's death, the second woman's death. Well, these crimes do all precede the murder of Elizabeth Short, and the cases of the two women do show the escalation typical of lust murders. The first victim was repeatedly stabbed, and the second one was also brutally stabbed, but she was also shot. And the note on her wall in lipstick read, "For heaven's sake, catch me before I kill more. I cannot control myself." But neither of those victims was dismembered. The last of those three Chicago victims, though, was a six-year-old girl who was abducted from her bedroom. Following an anonymous tip, the girl's body parts were found dispersed in various street sewers near her home. They also found a dismemberment site discovered in the laundry room at a local apartment building. But I have a real problem with trying to link this case to the other two Chicago women, let alone to Dahlia. The little girl's family received a ransom note, not a lipstick message, and then there were associated phone calls. Now, a local teenager who actually had nothing to do with the case actually made the fake ransom calls, but the source of the note is still unknown. But the girl's kidnapping shows a completely different motive than the typical lust murderer. The three lipstick murders were eventually tied to a 17-year-old boy, a Chicago boy named William Hirons, who ultimately confessed to the crimes in exchange for a plea bargain. Hirons was a known and convicted serial burglar, but in none of the lipstick murders was anything taken except for the six-year-old girl. Nevertheless, Hirons went to jail for life, but nearly immediately recanted his confession, saying it was coerced by extreme police brutality. It certainly seems like Hiron's claims could be true. I mean, the community was begging for a perpetrator, and police delivered. Now, given the scant and contradictory evidence, I find it difficult to link the three lipstick murders together at all, let alone to Hiron's. And I strongly believe that had those killings happened today, the child abduction would not have been linked to the other two. To me, that case sounds like a kidnapping gone bad, after which the perpetrator had to dispose of the little girl's body parts. In my experience, dismemberment usually simply reflects the desperation of someone to hide a killing. It's not the after effect of a lust murderer. And as an MO, does hiding body parts in sewers, as in the six-year-old Chicago girl's case, compare to leaving them out for display like the Dahlia and Ripper cases? Even if by some stretch Elizabeth Short's killing in Los Angeles is linked to the lipstick murderers, Chicago's Hirons is definitely not the Dahlia's killer. He had been in custody for over 6 months when her body was found. Though Hirons died in prison, he was likely the wrong guy, even for the murders of which he was convicted. If so, perhaps the true lipstick murderer did kill the Black Dahlia as well, but I doubt it. Like the notorious Ripper killings, I think the world will never know whose lust and rage caused those terrible murders.